Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kot. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to welcome brother-sister rock duo, The Fiery Furnaces.
Plus, we'll review the new album from rapper Lupe Fiasco.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now to welcome our newest affiliate.
Greg, we are now going to be on in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, downstate Illinois, on WGLT.
All right.
We decided to check in with a cool local record store called The Waiting Room in Normal. Jared Alcorn is the manager there. We got him on the phone. Jared, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks.
So, you know, when we have a new affiliate come on board, we like to welcome them with a little chat with somebody who's in the center of the musical community. You're the hippest record store. What are people buying?
Well, we had a few. Some of the biggest ones for us this year was Arcade Fire, Feist, Grinder Man, Modest Mouse, The Shins.
All good records. Good taste in Bloomington, Illinois.
I'd like to think so.
How about locally, man? What's the coolest local band?
Well, we've had a few that have been doing pretty well this year. Probably Laser Eyes has sold the most, which is pretty good for a band that's not even together anymore.
Oh, really? So this is a posthumous release?
Yep.
Let's hear a little of this. Let's see what Laser Eyes sounds like. So that sounds like it starts out in sleep territory and then goes into this kind of death metal, industrial thrash kind of thing.
A little bit.
That's neat. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jared.
Yeah, thank you.
That's The Police, of course, with a song called One World, and 2007 it was The Police's world, at least as far as the touring industry is concerned. The Police's 2007 reunion tour, their first in two decades, grossed $212 million, Jim. You know, a nice idea for these three guys to get back together again, an indication of where the biases of the concert industry market lie. They love these reunion tours. They love these classic rock acts coming back out on the road again because they can charge exorbitant ticket prices and make a lot of money on them. Number two on the list was one of your favorites, Genesis. Not even the original Genesis, but the three guys
from the 90s Genesis.
Yeah. Yeah. They got back together again. They had the second biggest tour of 2007 with $129 million. So what does that say about the state of the concert industry when your two biggest touring acts are bands that have not been together for, you know, at least 10 years, in the case of the Police, 20 years. They come back on the road and they clean up at the box office, whereas a lot of newer acts are struggling to make that kind of, anywhere near that kind of money on the road.
Well, there were a couple of standouts. You know, Future Sex Love Show, Justin Timberlake's jaunt, that grossed $126.8 million. That was number three on the list. And Christina Aguilera was down at number nine with a little more than $48 million. But you're right. The rest of the names are hoary old war horses. You know, Rod Stewart and Roger Waters. And if this, of course, doesn't even take into account StubHub and all the aftermarket sales. I got a press release from them the other day, which basically scalpers crowing about what a great year they had. Mm-hmm. You know, money going in the hands of speculators as opposed to fans, and certainly the artists aren't benefiting.
Yeah, the secondary ticket market on these big shows, in other words, these scalpers and brokers, had another banner year in 2007. But the concert industry as a whole, Jim, I think got some really disturbing news. Okay, so the Police had a big year, Genesis had a big year, Justin Timberlake did as well, but the concert industry as a whole was down 10.2% in 2007 to $2.6 billion. And even more alarmingly, attendance was down nearly 20% to 51 million. And again, these promoters are saying, where are the new acts? Where are the up-and-comers? Where are the mid-level acts? Well, you know, these people have no one to blame but themselves. I mean, who are they developing? Who are they putting out on the road? When you're putting your energies and your money into the Police and Genesis reuniting, you know, and it hurt to have a band like the White Stripes, who was about to go out on tour, yeah, not being able to tour. So you're not seeing the new generation of bands taking the place of the Police reunion tour or the Genesis reunion
tour. Well, except for Hannah Montana, and you skipped that show.
Exactly, with good reason. But you're not seeing those acts coming up. And you know what? Good riddance to those kind of reunion tours. I mean, when you have to pay $100 plus to go see the Police reunite, you know, that's completely out of the league of most people. And I don't think people should be expected to pay those kind of prices in future years, because that's what the concert industry wants. That's Running Down a Dream from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, the title song, as it were, from a four-hour documentary that has been airing on the Sundance Channel in recent months and is now out on DVD, a four-hour documentary about the career and life of Tom Petty and his band, the Heartbreakers, directed by no slouch in the directing department, Peter Bogdanovich, Oscar-winning director, who's broke through in the early 70s with a movie called The Last Picture Show, one of the most acclaimed Hollywood movies ever. He also directed The Mask with Cher in it in the mid-80s. Got a long history in Hollywood, got a long history as a documentarian and a journalist.
And people probably know him recently from appearing on The Sopranos.
Absolutely.
As the Shrinks Shrink. We've got Peter Bogdanovich on the phone from his hotel room in New York City. Welcome to Sound Opinions, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter, you have done a four-hour documentary on Tom Petty, Running Down a Dream, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It's airing on the Sundance Channel. It is out in DVD. You are a man who picks big subjects. You have done major work on people like Orson Welles. You've written a book about Orson Welles. You've written a book and done a documentary on John Ford. Tom Petty, does he fit into that pantheon of great men, great artists in American history? Obviously, he does for you.
Yeah, well, that was what interested me about him. I think he's a very talented, gifted, brilliant American artist, and I approached the documentary with that point of view.
Yeah, when did you become a fan? I mean, what was it about Petty that interested
you? I didn't become a fan until I did this movie.
Really?
I'd heard a couple of songs, but I didn't know much about him, which is one of the reasons that interested me, because, I mean, I knew he was good, and Tom liked my movies and wanted to meet me and was interested in having me do this.
Mm-hmm.
So we met in November of 05, and we hit it off very well immediately, and that was the beginning of it. You know, I just thought he was so American in the best possible sense. It was really a native American artist with a sense of Americana that was very acute, I thought.
It's interesting, Peter, because I think what you see with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and the more you watch your documentary, you realize this band has had a 30-year run. And it's not like they're the Rolling Stones, where it's this multi-million-dollar mega corporation. I mean, the Heartbreakers are, I suppose, are a corporation in their own right. But what this is really is a story of a working American rock and roll band, and the rarity of being able to hang together. It's almost like peeling back the curtain. And how does a band work, and how does it stay together for that length of time? I mean, is that how you started seeing the story? Because that's the way I see your movie in a way.
Yes, it is. It's very much the story. You know, I determined right away, right from the first meeting, that I'd like Tom to tell the story. I found him very charismatic in a non-show dog kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of reminded me of, not specifically, but he reminded me of somebody like Gary Cooper, somewhat laconic, laid back, the epitome of cool, actually, and very and quintessentially American, Southern American, too. As you know, the South is a font of extraordinary writers, from Mark Twain and Thomas Wolfe and William Faulkner and Truman Capote. I mean, the Tennessee Williams is an amazing... Most of the great American writers somehow come from the South. And I think there's something about the South that just sets it apart. And Tom is very much a representative of that. So I decided early on that we weren't going to have a narrator. We're going to have Tom tell the story, and of course the band and the people around him. So we interviewed about 28 people.
Yeah, you do a very thorough job of journalism, and Peter, you are a great journalist. You've done some amazing work as a journalist even before you were a director.
Thank you.
And it shows in this documentary. The thing that I'm intrigued about is you got Benmont Tench to talk. I mean, what an amazing feat. I mean, he's a great guy. He has refused interviews up and down. I've tried to talk to him for 20 years.
Really?
Yeah, how did you get him to talk? I mean, he's not a guy who doesn't... He just routinely says, well, I'm sorry, I just don't do them.
Well, I mean, the whole band agreed to do interviews for the movie. That was just became a given. And the only person who... former band member who didn't agree to be interviewed is the ex-drummer, Stan Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
But we had interviews with him in the archives that, in Tom's archive that we were able to use, so he's very much a part of the movie. I think the fact that I was asking the questions, it was very important to me that I do the interviews and that I ask the questions, even though in many cases the producer, George Drakoulias, who's a record producer and who had the idea to put us together, Tom and me.
Mm-hmm.
George would slip me questions as we were doing the interview. When it got to certain something that there was an interesting tangent or something, a nuance that I wasn't aware of, he would pass me a note. But it was very important to me that the interviewees were talking to me when it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because I bring a certain baggage into the room, and I felt that they'd be more honest and more straightforward with me than they would with somebody else.
No, it's true. I thought that was a failing in Scorsese's documentary with Dylan, is that he never sat down and interviewed Dylan himself.
Yeah.
Not to diss another director. But Peter, it's a 4-hour film, and it sucks you right through. It doesn't feel like it's that long, both on Sundance and on DVD.
Well, that's a big compliment. I'm glad. That was what we were trying to do. At a certain point in the process, we realized that it was going to be long. I mean, I knew it was going to be, it couldn't be short because we're dealing with 30 years. And in fact, you mentioned the Scorsese Dylan picture, and Marty took 3 hours and 40 minutes to tell 6 years of Dylan. And I figured if that's the case, well, why shouldn't we take 4 hours to tell 30 years of Tom Petty?
Well, now, he's really a self-effacing character, Tom Petty. Greg and I have both interviewed him any number of times. He's always most loquacious when he's telling stories about other people. He's always wanting to tell us George Harrison stories, which are very funny. But was there a point where he said to you, he started this ball rolling, but was there a point where he said to you, I don't know if I want this much of me up there on that screen?
There were certain areas that took a little pushing to keep them going.
Mm-hmm. I think there's two kind of key revelations for me about this movie. One was you got into these issues about his upbringing, his relationship with his father specifically, as being fuel for his artistic freedom.
There was an extreme rage in me that from time to time would show its head through a lot of my life. Any sort of injustice just outraged me. I just couldn't contain myself. And this comes from my dad just being so incredibly verbally abusive to me. And he was certainly physically abusive at times. He would give me pretty good beatings most of my life.
How did that sort of emerge, that that childhood really shaped him, and he played rock and roll, and it, rock and roll really did save this kid's life?
Yeah, that's true. Well, we had glimmers of it for in the interviews with Tom. He made certain references to his dad and the situation he was in and the difficult childhood, but he didn't get into details, but other people did. His brother told me about it, and his daughter mentioned it. So once I felt that Tom really trusted me, I pushed him to tell me more about that. Because we didn't do all our interviews in one lump. We did them over a period of months.
You know, one other extraordinary scene in the movie I thought was the scene from the early 90s where Petty is in a recording studio, it looks like, with Roger McGuinn, one of his heroes, the founder of the Byrds. And there's a record company guy there trying to get Roger to record a certain song, and Petty's looking at the song going, what is this crap?
The A&R guy, the guy from the record company, seemed awfully young to me. I don't think he understood, you know, the depth of the artist he was working with.
Sorry, Roger.
I appreciate it, man.
Can't hold it in any longer because I love you so much.
I love you, man. You're doing what you do, and that's great.
No, we're not trying to f*** him around.
I know you're not trying to f*** him around, but you are if you make him do this song.
Because sometimes the commercial road, you know, like thinking that that's the road to take isn't always the road to take. Sometimes just doing stuff from your heart and being really honest with people works much better.
Well, let's change some lyrics.
Well, why don't you just give him a song?
I'm just curious how you came across that piece of film footage.
Well, that was interesting. We were interviewing Roger, and Roger brought it up. He says, we've got this, you know, this confrontation that happened, and somebody shot it, and Roger had a copy of it. Tom didn't have a copy of it, but Roger did.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about it till Roger brought it up. And I thought it was a perfect example of, you know, Tom's integrity and the steadfastness in the face of authority.
Yeah.
He was going to stand, he wasn't going to back down from his opinion that it was a lousy song, that this guy shouldn't be singing it. It's one of the highlights of the movie. In fact, in a couple of screenings I've been with audiences where we had, you know, 400 people or something, there was considerable cheering in that section.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so on. Particularly the screening we had in L.A. where it was a lot of industry people.
Petty's a guy who put his money where his mouth is, fought with his record company to charge consumers less. We've been talking to Peter Bogdanovich, director of Running Down a Dream, the extraordinary new Tom Petty film. Peter, I think we're remiss if we let you go. As a fellow rock fan, as a film great on your own, if we didn't ask you, what's your favorite rock movie of all time? We had Roger Ebert on the show. We did this once. And, I mean, Greg and I can talk about this forever. We're just fans of the genre. But obviously, you went into this making this rock documentary. And every documentarian in this field that I've talked to has always said, I didn't want to make a rockumentary. Few of them succeed in making a film that transcends that.
Well, I don't know. I looked at a lot of the documentaries that have been made, and I didn't want to make one like them. What I wanted to do was a vision that I had right after Tom and I talked, right as I was beginning to work on it. I said I wanted a movie where we had a lot of people talking, but we didn't sit on their faces for very long. I didn't want a lot of talking heads cross-cutting. I wanted to have a lot of images. I wanted the talking heads not to be talking heads so much as narrators. I wanted it to be more of a movie,
mm-hmm.
where you could follow the story visually. So I had this vision of what the movie should be like. I wish you could say it was easy to achieve that goal. It was a really twisting, turning road to get to where we got. But it did turn out the way I imagined it would. But there were many times along the year and a half, almost 2 years that we spent on it, where I thought, I don't know how we're going to get to this place.
Yeah.
Because it was hard, you know.
Well, it absolutely works. Thank you, Peter, for sharing some time with us. I also have to say, as a guy who grew up in Jersey City and Hoboken, man, The Sopranos, you were great.
Thank you so much. You're very kind.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we welcome the Fiery Furnaces for an interview and a live performance in the Jim and Kay Mabey studio.
I went on down into the duplex as the dead, where the shades are drawn and the shadows shut. Unless you know the magic word, I said I'm sad but often heard. Well, bite your lip and spin around three times.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and we are about to be joined by the Fiery Furnaces. Greg, they came together back in 2002 in Brooklyn and have put out a half dozen albums since then that have kind of captivated the indie rock underground. But we know Matt and Eleanor Friedberger from growing up here in Oak Park, Illinois. Let's go to the Jim and Kay Mabey studio. We're going to talk to them and have a live performance.
We're here in the studio with the Fiery Furnaces. Back behind the wall of pain, the drummer, Robert D'Amico. We have Jason Lowenstein on bass. Jason, you know, a little side project here with the Fiery Furnaces, also in a band called Sebado. And then, of course, Matthew and Eleanor Friedberger, the founding members of the Fiery Furnaces. Welcome.
Thanks.
Hi, thank you.
You can call me Matt, Greg.
Okay, Matt. Fifth album with Fiery Furnaces, Widow City. And let's go back to the beginning, because Eleanor and Matt have been standing on the street corner in their native Oak Park, Illinois, this last couple of days signing autographs. I'm sure you guys get ticker tape parades when you come home. And
actually, the opposite happened today. For the first time, I got pulled over while we were driving here by an Oak Park police officer.
So welcome home, Eleanor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank
wow.
you.
He let me off. But
yeah, when he saw your ID, he was very, very friendly, so don't know if that was accidental or not. Maybe he's a fan.
Now, I have to ask you this. Eleanor was living in Brooklyn in 2001. Matt, you were out here in Oak Park.
No, I was in Queens in 2001.
Oh, okay. So, but you moved out. At one point, you moved out to New York to form a band with Eleanor, correct?
Well, I moved there just to move there for kicks, you know, to enjoy the high life in New York City. Uh-huh. Going to the clubs and stuff.
Making the scene.
Yeah, but then Eleanor was there too, and so she enrolled me to help her in her band.
So, Eleanor, you brought Matt in to your band.
Exactly, yeah.
I have to say, forming a band with a family member, I mean, I love my wife dearly, I love my sister dearly, but forming a band with them would be the last thing I would think I would want to do.
You should try it, Greg.
Yeah, how do you know? I don't know until you try.
Okay.
It's good to, you know, then you... you know why you don't like, you know, when you're in a band with friends, you think, at some point you think, why am I hanging out with this? Why am I calling this idiot on the phone? Even if you like them to some extent. But you're meant to call your sister up on the phone at some point, so you never ask that question, really. Does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't, actually.
Yeah, really, yeah.
You're stuck with your relatives, you know, so it's harder to quit. Whereas, you know, I love to quit things personally, so I would always quit bands.
Yeah.
But how are you going to quit your sibling? You know, you're always going to have to deal with them to some extent. So it seems harder to quit them than you persevere a little bit more.
Right. Before we get into the music, why don't we hear a song?
We'd like to play a song called Japanese Slippers, which is a song Matt and I, it's a nice collaboration. We wrote the words together in a room together, which doesn't happen that often.
Mm-hmm.
And here it goes.
Down at the shell shed, the boys are picking out their pearls. The hole in my middle lets the rain get in. I bought 22 ounces from the petrol park, waiting at the line. None of them gonna make it back in time. The Geraldine and me can begin. Mr. Raymond's Japanese slippers comes creeping in. I sit with the fat on my face and sip shandies all day. I lend a sleep standing up so I don't have to make the bed. No tobacco for my rolling papers, warm water in my cup. I have to wait all morning. Geraldine and me can begin. Mr. Raymond and Japanese slippers will come creeping in. Load up with turkey carpets and green glass diamonds. I drove back and forth for five long rolling moons. And every day and every night I thought of back at home. And I couldn't get the notion out of my head that said, but Geraldine and me can begin. Mr. Raymond's Japanese slippers comes creeping in. Everything is always a little late. But tripping on those Japanese slippers seems to be my fate. Job to cut down all the poplar trees, and I'd sit on the stumps and listen to the finches and stare out at the field and eat honey out of the jar and wonder why it always seemed like the Geraldine and me can begin. Mr. Raymond and his Japanese slippers are come creeping in.
Japanese Slippers by the Fiery Furnaces, one of the standout tracks on Widow City, their sixth or seventh album, depending on how you're counting. Eleanor, you said it's rare for you and Matt to write lyrics together. You know, your lyrics get a lot of attention with good reason. I mean, there's not that many people that use a word like finches or pomegranates or puce or all the, I mean, you know, very literary-minded, very colorful, enigmatic lyrics that paint pictures in your head. How did that song come to be written together, and how do you write when you're apart?
Well, I just had a few lines, like, I sit with the fan on my face and sip shandies all day, I learn to sleep, stand up, so I don't have to make the bed. And then Matt added the first verse, and then I remember just sitting on the couch together going back and forth with the other lines, you know.
So those first couple of lines revealed what the song was going to be about?
No, not in that instance, which is actually pretty rare because Matt has a good idea, I think, of what each song is going to be about before he actually writes it, you know.
Well, because there was this thing in your bio this time around about you sitting with a Ouija board trying to write the lyrics.
Well, this record, the music was supposed to be early 70s sounding, so we wanted to have the lyrics fit that be from or of, you know, pop culture artifacts from early 70s. So Eleanor did some research. Why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, in our grandmother's basement is all kinds of stuff. Like she never throws anything away, which is lucky for us. So she had a big stack of early 70s House and Garden and House Beautiful magazines, which Matt and I pored over for a few weeks.
And then, so five of the songs on the record were written from the scripts we made, you know, stealing the phrases from the ads in those old magazines. And then the other 11 I wrote to try to fit in with those. And there's a lot in those sort of old ads, there's a lot of pop sort of spirituality, you know, after psychedelia sort of numerology, astrology things. So the old Parker Brothers Ouija board game, I instantly thought of, you know, that's what I needed to imagine to try to write lyrics to fit with these other.
I remember that well. I think we had one in my house, and then The Exorcist came out, and my mother threw it away.
You couldn't have that now. You couldn't have a devil talking machine marketed to children nowadays.
Yeah.
The country has taken a step back.
So you guys are satanic rockers. This is a good thing.
We love things having to do with Satanism. We're not satanic rockers in this.
Oh, we'll make that clear.
Yeah.
It's a Jimmy Page reference. I didn't subscribe to Aleister Crowley's theories. I just enjoyed reading about them.
That's right.
But there's a lot of alliteration, a lot of multisyllable words crammed into small spaces.
Yes.
First time I heard you guys, I thought, I haven't heard anything like this in the rock context. The best context I could think of for it was like a Gilbert and O'Sullivan operetta. You know, it's like
a Gilbert O'Sullivan operetta.
Yes, Gilbert O'Sullivan. Yeah, exactly. Gilbert and Sullivan operettas.
Well, we don't have as, if you can remember Alone Again Naturally, it's got some beautiful chord changes. But, so yeah, we like a lot of big noisy words. There's a lot of alliteration, too many syllables for the tune to give it that nice awkward rhythmic variety, uh-huh. Especially when the song is a simple four square, you know, 4x4 rock and roll
right.
number.
Yeah, and of course Eleanor has the job to sing these, and every time I talk to Eleanor, I always bring this up, but I think it's really amazing what you have to sing and how you sing it. Was this a job that you ever protested against and saying, you know, this is just too much?
Not recently. I mean, I remember the first a song called Straight Street from Blueberry Boat. Matt, yeah, it goes like that. Matt gave me the lyrics, and I said, I can't say all these words. You know, I actually said, I can't do this. And he said, just try. It's going to sound great. And then it's kind of been like that ever since.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's have another song.
Okay, you want to do the title track?
Yes, we're going to play the title track of the record Widow City in a nice little waltz style here. Hopefully it'll sound nice and something you can listen to by the fire. You want to count it off?
You're going to start it though, right?
One, two, three, one, two, three.
Send via the swift dromedary to loosen her ways on the odd and even days. Said the lion has come up from his thicket. They've managed to void my lottery ticket. A drunk on wormwood widow city. Widow city's drunk on wormwood. Suffered the degenerate plan of a slave to find. And foxes on the mountain girls, the foxes on the mountain girls, so to negotiate the deserts and pits. You can't rely on your dim wits. Wag your head and ping your clocks, ready for the rendezvous with the sticks and the stocks. Said the wicked ones were wayside, was sent via the sweet dromedary to verse it on the odd and even days. I'm drunk on wormwood widow sin. Widow sin is drunk on wormwood. Tomorrow night when the sun sets at night, I might need to tangle myself with the degenerate plan of a strange little vine. And they've made my chain even heavier. My chain even heavier, if you can imagine. A drunk on wormwood widow sin. A widow sin is drunk on wormwood. Tomorrow night when the sun sets at night, I might need to tangle myself with the degenerate plan of a strange divine.
Widow City from the Fiery Furnaces, and sounded great. The band in a live setting is sort of a different beast than it is in the studio. cut up songs, mixing up the lyrics, mixing up the songs, and melding them together. Why is that?
Well, we get to I get to make a different record when we play live. You know, it gets to be we've got the record we made, and then we get to rearrange all the songs for live, and it's as if it's a different record. It's just fun. It's just Who-ism. I mean, whenever you read about the Who as a kid in those old books, they'd say, oh, live, you know, they made a record one way, and then live it would be mm-hmm. different, even if the arrangements weren't that different.
But right.
Though mm-hmm. For this record, we've been playing, for this tour, we've been playing the songs with the same tunes live. Mm-hmm. Often we would change the tunes, just keep the words, but
right.
Now it's a little different.
I think that this has been a banner year for concept albums in a lot of ways, and for a return to really ambitious kind of pop music that was prevalent in the progressive rock era. I mean, the Decemberists did it, and Arcade Fire in a lot of ways, and you guys now. You know,
R. Kelly.
Well, yeah, that's a different kind of concept, a little more one-dimensional.
We identify more with the R. Kelly side than the other bands you just mentioned.
Really?
Definitely.
All right, so whether we're talking about R. Kelly or the Decemberists, concept album was a dirty word in underground rock and roll, period, for yeah. a long time. And yet you don't shy away from that ambition.
Well, I mean, there were some, you know, I think a Zen Arcade, the Who's Could Do record, mm-hmm. you know. I'm not a big Sonic Youth fan, but Daydream Nation seemed like a kind of a concept record. Mm. We definitely think in terms of albums, you know, album rock.
Are you getting a sense from your fans that they're listening? I mean, this is supposed to be the iPod generation. You know, and Greg and I certainly hear from a lot of listeners who still love that, you know, A to Z musical journey that an album can create. Yeah. But do you get a sense that people are if they're loading into their iPod, they're still starting at song 1 and ending at song 15?
No. No, I think people really, they don't, it's very rare that they hear it in the same way that you, the way you intended it. They don't hear it in the context that you want to put it in usually. But like I say, that it's fun to have people use things in totally different ways from which you intended them. You know, you
sure.
have it, and that's how songs get life. You know, that's the whole point of putting them out, is people use them in ways that you don't understand or don't like. But that's what's fun. That's actually more fun to hear about people using things in ways you don't get.
Since we're talking all this stuff about 70s and arena rock and the sounds of the 70s, what was the first big mega concert each of you went to?
Mine was Robert Plant at the Rosemont Horizon.
Solo Plant.
Yeah, but it was the first tour he started doing Zeppelin songs again.
I think we were at that show, right, Greg?
Probably.
Yeah.
I was 13.
Yeah, we weren't.
Yeah, I wasn't 13.
But the voice is still there. It's down an octave, but it's still pretty powerful.
Well, I mean, this is a side note, but that was very memorable because we got moved from the balcony to the second row.
Hey.
Because my friend bought a t-shirt straight away and put it on over her shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody dragged, you know, I don't know, but they had missed, you know, nobody bought one. No one bought the expensive tickets,
I guess. The Golden Circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
So was your life changed by seeing Robert Plant?
No.
I mean, so you didn't enjoy the experience?
No, I loved. No, yeah, it was amazing.
Matt,
I didn't go. The first time I saw a big show was seeing Black Sabbath in 1999 or something like that. I never went to a big rock show.
Mm.
First show I went to was seeing the Replacements at the Riviera in 1980, August 7th, 1987, or something like that.
So you were an indie rocker through and through.
Well, you know, indie, it's funny because they had, you know, back in then it was punk rock and college rock. I didn't know what, I don't think I remember what indie rock was. I liked, you know, the things that were on the small, I liked what was supposed to be cool.
Yeah.
Frankly. But of course the music was good. But, that's the only rock concert I've ever been to. Like a rock concert.
On that level.
Yeah. I mean, I've been at festivals, but only because we were playing at them. So.
Mm-hmm. How about another song?
Yeah, give us some of that indie rock.
Oh, gosh.
How about some college rock?
Yeah.
No, we don't want to play any college rock. Well, you want to play Ex-Guru?
Yeah, we're going to play a song called Ex-Guru.
One of those blonde ladies had a certain hold on me. I went to all the seminars by the airport in the Doubletree. Even let her use nephew's seaplane in the Bahamas for free. But she means nothing to me now. myself every day. She means nothing to me now. I tell myself every single day. I'm quite convinced I escaped her sway. Burned all my clothes with eucalyptus juice. Ripped out the floors and painted all the platforms pews. I went so far as to sacrifice a second snake to Zeus, but she means nothing to me now. I tell myself that every day. She means nothing to me now. I tell myself every single day. I'm still convinced I escaped her sway. But when she mopes in the moonlight on her mesa in March, does she kick up a thunderstorm when she thinks of my betrayal? Nothing to me now. She means nothing to me now. That was the first time we've ever done that, like that.
Bob D'Amico, Jason Lowenstein, Matt Friedberger, and Eleanor Friedberger, Fiery Furnaces, thanks for coming into Sound Opinion. It's been a real treat.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for rolling with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
For more of the Fiery Furnaces, you can hear some live songs at soundopinions.org, and we're going to be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with a review of the new album from Lupe Fiasco.
I want to restore. Extension cord about the needlepoint therapy blues, and then I knew I wanna restore the beer to take my mind off these tears. I wanna restore it in a beer.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
If you are what you say you are, a superstar, then have no fear. The crowd is here and the light.
A fresh, cool young Lou, trying to cash his microphone, check 212. Wanna believe my own hype, but it's too untrue. The world brought me to my knees, what have you brung you? Did you improve on the design, did you do something new? Where you naming on the guest list, who brung you? You, the more famous person you come through, and the sexy lady next to you, you come too. And then the hitman, standing outside of heaven, waiting for God to come and get me. I'm too uncouth, unschooled to the rules, and too gumshoe, too much of a newcomer, and too uncool, like Shadow and LaVille. I battle with it well, though.
That is a song called Superstar from the second album by Chicago rapper Lupe Fiasco, called The Cool. This guy broke through in a big way in 2006. The former Wasalu Mohammed Jaco, who was a guest on Sound Opinions last year, was a then 24-year-old rapper, started the year by guesting on Touch the Sky by Kanye West, followed it up with his debut, Food and Liquor, which was, you know, delayed for years by the major label, finally came out, sells 300,000 copies, and he has a big hit with this song, Kick Push, which you and I absolutely loved, a rap song about the joys of skateboarding. Mm-hmm. Did for skateboards, I think, what the Beach Boys did for surfboards. How does Lupe Fiasco follow that up? He was kind of under the gun in 2007. He had a tough year. His father died, a beloved aunt in his family died, he was touched by both of these losses, and then a friend who he often called his business partner, sometimes he called him his manager, Charles Patton, was sentenced to 44 years in jail on drug charges. This is interesting because as a devout Muslim, Lupe is against drugs. You know, he called his album Food and Liquor because that's like a source of community in the black neighborhoods of Chicago. You know, one of the only things that people get together around the food and liquor on the corner of every block. But he doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. He doesn't do drugs. And he's got this image. He's a nerd. He's a science fiction loving, skateboarding, video game playing, middle class African American. And he's not ashamed to rap about things that are considered pretty darn geeky. You know, it's kind of like Urkel grown up to become a rapper, and he's proud of that. One of his favorite albums of all time, he says, is Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. He wanted to make a record that was like that. I talked to him just a couple of weeks ago, and I said, what the heck are you talking about? And he said, I want to put out a record that's strong, cohesive, and I want to say watchable, like a movie. Did he succeed? Let's play a track from it, and then we'll get into a discussion of The Cool. This is a song called High Definition. It features a cameo from a rapper who doesn't have any problems with sex and drugs and life on the wild side, Snoop Dogg, but it's still Lupe's show here on Sound Opinions.
Yeah. Get around, head and stare. My life's in high definition. Watch with your eyes, follow with your ears. I don't need no definition. My life's in high definition.
In my return, it's more like a re-up. I hold a hole like a teacup, whirl in one hand, while the other hand throw the piece up. My other hand throwing weed without the E up. I got like five more, man, I'm something like Shiva. In that fall of Rome, number four, deluxe. See, I've been around the world like the gnome, but I come from a zone where the homes all beat up. The folks, unknowns, and the stones all meet up. Police tap my phones, got my songs on speaker. Say he's back, the poems, got their domes all geeked up. To get up on their domes and become young leaders. Oprah put it on my culture, now if that ain't wrong. I'm as got it from the rhymers, now if that ain't blown. They gave my man 44, now if that ain't long. I put it all on my shoulders, now if that ain't strong. I made it out alive from the streets of the West Side, C-H-I. Now if that ain't home, you better tell them.
Use T-Funk, don't need permission. My life's in high definition.
With your eyes, follow with your ears.
Yeah, don't need no intermission. My life's in high definition.
And in my flyness, I've become the hero and the sidekick. The rider and the nigga that I ride with. In your ear, like the maker of the vibrant. Assalamu alaikum to the maker of the vibrant. The mother niggas on vibe with. I was about three when the eyes went. But I can see everything that you're trying to be. You can't hide it. Why you coming out your throats like a Heimlich? I came up out the belly like a hop script. Only my circumstance revised it. Hijacked the role and went and shot the pilot. I'm trying to go public so I can get the private. Then send Busy to go and get the pirates. Then hit Africa, try to fix the virus. Go back to the hood, tell Huggy open the hydrants. R.I.P. Stack B, I'ma keep you alive, kid. Dressed in something so fresh and wonderful. F-N-F-N, S-N-O-O-P.
Lupe Fiasco with a song called High Definition from his second album called The Cool. Lupe Fiasco with the difficult second record. The first one, of course, is the breezy look back at youthfulness. You mentioned the skateboarding song, Kick Push Jim. There was sort of a breezy undertow to that record. It was easy to love, melodic, just an easy listen for a lot of people, even those people who say, quote-unquote, I hate hip-hop, but I like Lupe Fiasco. The second record, wow. Talk about a turn for the darkness. This is a much heavier record in almost every way. He was talking about serious subjects on the debut. This one, though, the music, in a lot of ways, reflects that seriousness as well. It's a much darker, much heavier record. There's some preachiness here. You hear on the hip-hop message boards, Lupe getting a lot of stick for being, you know, the preacher, the guy who's wagging his finger and saying, you know, naughty, naughty, you guys shouldn't be doing these kind of things. As you said, he's a devout Muslim. There's a song here where he personifies a cheeseburger and says, why, I'm bad for you. You should not eat me.
Hey, he had a whole lot of cheese. Plus he was the Mac, had a whole lot of C's. Made a lot of against fat, gave a whole lot of G's. Grams, man, he had a whole lot of these. And he would let you hold like a whole lot of keys. Even if you lose some, he would give you new ones. Twice the bread, it's like he had two buns. And he had a whole lot of C's.
His subject matter is really interesting in the way he presents it. The sonic settings remind me a lot of not only his fellow Chicagoan Kanye West, but Outkast, in the way he blows out the margins of what people think hip-hop should sound like and takes it into some really interesting areas.
Well, he's collaborating with Queens of the Stone Age?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Uncle, the British producer, he's got a track on here with Patrick Stump of Fall Out Boy. I'm not a huge Fall Out Boy fan, but I have to say the song Little Weapon with Patrick Stump doing the production on that song is terrific.
I killed another man today. Shot him in his back as he ran away. Then I blew up his hut with a hand grenade. Cut his wife though, then she put her hands to pray. Just five more dogs, then we can get a soccer ball. That's what my commander say. How old? Well, I'm like 10, 11. Been fighting since I was like 6 or 7. Now, I don't know.
In that song, he's talking about boy soldiers in Africa. This is the kind of subject matter, this is the kind of lyricism you don't hear on a lot of hip-hop records these days. You know, there's also a mini-narrative we're weaving through here, Jim, with three characters. A hustler called The Cool, this menacing father figure called The Game, and a temptress called The Streets.
Well, I was wondering when you were going to get to that. Now, have you figured that out? Because I think it's got something to do with a fatherless kid being raised on the streets, and he squanders his potential, you know, dealing drugs. I mean, that I've got him there. But then the zombies come in, and I don't know. That's when he loses me.
Yeah, you know, I don't think the narrative, you know, he's a very dense lyricist anyway. He's not the easiest guy to pick up on the first or second swipe through. But I think he intended to make this record a dense listen, one of those records that is going to grow over time. I think it's a less easy record to like than the first one, but the hooks are still there. The lyricism is still there. It's a wonderful record. I just don't see this record being a huge hit, but I don't think Lupe cares about that. His whole career has been about what is cool and trying to make the uncool things in African-American culture cool again.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, the title The Cool comes from a lot of things that Dr. Cornel West has written about, you know, only when we start saying that reading and becoming an intellectual is cooler than becoming a drug dealer are we going to break this cycle that the African-American community is in. Lupe is not afraid to say, you know, I like video games. I like comic books about zombies. You know, I don't like cheeseburgers. And on and on and on.
Right.
At the same time, by doing this mini-narrative, the songs that link together about the kid who's losing his way as a drug dealer, he gets to play, you know, he's having his cake and eating it too. You see what he's doing. He's playing, you know, the tough guy on the streets. There are raps about women, which are, you know, I mean, it's certainly PG-13, but still, he doesn't really think in those terms. There's raps about being a drug dealer, but he's playing a character. So he's getting to do it both ways. The same thing Common did on his last album. Lyrically, it loses me a bit, but musically, this is an incredibly inventive album. You know, the stuff that Rhymefest, Common, Kanye West at the head of the class, and now Lupe Fiasco, the stuff that they're doing, I mean, is really going back to the heyday of A Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and Beastie Boys circa Paul's Boutique, and we are seeing a sort of invention and musicality in hip-hop, proud to say, coming out of Chicago, that we haven't seen in 10 or 15 years. People who say that rap isn't music, I mean, they have to listen to this. I give this a buy it for me on our buy it, burn it, trash it scale.
I agree with you, Jim. It's a buy it record all the way.
Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, very exciting news. The Swell Season, Marketa Irglova and Glenn Hansard, who are probably going to be up for an Oscar nomination for Best Soundtrack for the movie Once.
Sounds good, Greg. As always, Sound Opinions was produced by our ace team of Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn, with some interning help from Dave Mahler and our fearless leader, executive producer Tori Southside Malatia, the man who looks even better in an ascot than Peter Bogdanovich.
In case you've missed any of our recent shows, here are some of the records we've reviewed on Sound Opinions.
King's Basin, a raisin in the sun was amazing. The joint on the dresser went on, jumped up, fish tank, it fell. Renee stuck, they shot her cousin LaVon, Neo the Buck. Willie was awful, pulled out the let off to. Grits fell on his leg, Kiana ripped him cold, Bowie, Valen, a Allen with the talent of six killers who just came home from straight Wallen.
That is The Heart Gently Weeps, a track from the new Wu-Tang Clan record, 8 Diagrams. Jim, it's hard to overestimate how important this group is in hip-hop history with its debut album only. If it had just come out with Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers in 1993, its place in hip-hop history would have been assured.
Absolutely.
Ghostface Killah is arguably the single most influential member of that very formidable posse of MCs in this group. And he's barely on this record. These guys are way more interested in their solo projects than they are in the Wu-Tang Clan itself. And as a result, each Wu-Tang Clan album has been a case of diminishing returns.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a letdown. But then so was Iron Flags. I mean, they've been scattered and the talents pulled in too many directions for too long.
What really needs to happen, Jim, is Ghostface and RZA need to bring their talents together. Clearly,
yeah,
they are the kingpins in the Wu-Tang empire right now, and they are not working together. So as a result, 8 Diagrams, the Wu-Tang Clan record, there's a few good tracks on there. I say burn it to that one. The Ghostface Killah record, the Big Doe Rehab, a big, big letdown. I say it's a trash it.
Well, I hate to say it, but I agree with you 100%. Burn the Wu-Tang record, trash the Ghostface.
Song called The Well from the new Damon and Naomi record, Within These Walls. They are fleshing out their sound in a way that has not occurred before in their 15-year career. Their previous records all sounded like bedroom recordings, very intimate, but not particularly expansive. This record with the brass and with the string section, we've got them coming out into the world. I love the sound on that particular song that we just played, The Well. The string and brass arrangements, I'm a little split on. I love the string sounds. I love most of the brass sounds. And I got to say, I respect Bob Rainey a great deal as a saxophonist. But there are moments on this record where I think, is this guy emulating Kenny G or something? I mean, the soprano, the soprano
oh,
sax
man.
Stuff is just a little sickly and a little too pretty. I wish he'd sort of soured it up a little bit, made it a little bit more keeping with that sort of eerie mood that this record
but
sets.
But that's a contrast to
it's
the fact that...
It's a little too pretty.
No, but Damon and
Naomi
are aware of the fact that they are true DIY underground musicians. And I think that their amateurism plays well off of Rainey's obvious accomplishment. I mean, this guy's a virtuoso, as you said, an underground great. I would give this one a buy it, as I would virtually everything they've done.
Well, you know, I'm not disagreeing with the buy it. I'll give it a buy it as well. You take that saxophone out of this thing, and it'd be about a perfect record. Just hate soprano saxophone,
all
I guess,
right,
unless
right.
Wayne Shorter's playing it.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. Now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Sound Opinions, this is Rich. I'm calling from Chicago. It breaks my heart when I listen to you guys talk intelligently about an album and then seemingly at the end reduce it to, I think it's a buy it record. I think it's a burn it record. It's like you're totally destroying everything else you've said by reducing it to this little sound bite. And it's like the thumbs up, thumbs down mentality. And I think it's what's wrong with a lot of criticism today. And I think you're kind of insulting your listeners by giving these kind of really simple ratings. All right, thanks again, guys. Doing a great job. So long.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.